I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Lacey Crawford was 15 years old when two 18-year-old upperclassmen at the elite St. Paul's boarding school, where the three were students, sexually assaulted her one night. She didn't tell anyone at the school, although the men did, and she had to contend with the hurtful and unfounded rumors about her and the sneers and looks from other students. Her memoir, Notes on a Silencing, is about what happened after this violent incident, how the school covered up the crime and blamed her for what happened, telling her family that she was not a good girl. When she threatened to testify against her attacker, she was told she was not welcome back at the school. She did return, graduated, and attended Princeton University. More recently, the school has been forced to confront its past behavior after a damning attorney general investigation, although findings about campus assaults have largely been kept secret. Lacey Crawford joins us by Skype to talk about the horror of what happened to her, how she coped, the role that gender and power played, and how privilege mattered more than the truth. Lacey Crawford, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're welcome. And thank you for writing this book. And to our listeners, I have to say there will be parts or could be parts of this interview that will be upsetting and for some even re-traumatizing. But I think it's important to have an open, honest, and difficult conversation about sexual assault. So I just want to make sure that people are aware of that. Lacey, going back to you and to the point of being honest about what happened to you and the commonness of sexual assault, I appreciate how honest you were in this book, even graphic. It was hard to read. Was it hard to write?
It wasn't hard to write. It wasn't as hard as I think, given the content, we might think it would be. And that's only because I had been living it for so long without the opportunity to use my own voice to tell my story. So as you said in the introduction, after the boys assaulted me, and it was a very ordinary trap that they set for me. I know this happens to girls and women all over the country all the time. They told everybody the next day in the form of a brag what had gone on. And I couldn't bring myself to tell a soul. I couldn't even find the words for it myself. So I've been living with the gossip, frankly, and the shame of the story for so long that the opportunity to tell it in my words was a kind of correction.
In fact, you say your husband said to you, quote, burn it all down.
Well, this was...
Go get them, right?
As you can imagine, there were significant conversations in my home about whether to actually put this story out into the world. And that followed what I discovered when I joined the 2017 New Hampshire State investigation into my school. If there was one silver lining to my assault, it's that it happened before the internet. It happened in 1990. So I have children who would never be able to Google my name and discover what it happened to me. And by putting this story into the world, you know, I've given up that privacy effectively. So that was my husband's way of saying, you know, we'll manage that. There are more important issues for us to tackle here.
In fact, part of that 2017 investigation, you found a number of documents about you that had been filed away.
Well, this was the remarkable thing, and this is why I chose to write this book. So I had thought that I had put the assault behind me the way so many of us do. I had moved on. I live my life. I am married. I have a family. I have my work. But I did join this investigation, and I did so completely privately. Only my husband knew. And in the course of my working with detectives in Concord, New Hampshire, who were wonderful, by the way, the school somehow found out that I was involved, and they contacted me through their lawyers and asked me to get in touch with them. And this began a sort of race to get a hold of documents. What Concord police ended up finding in my student file, which was that summer 25 years old, was documented evidence of the way the school, working with its lawyer, had mapped out a plan to silence me. I mean, this was the fancy footwork. This is how it's done. And I had known that this was done to me, but it was done to me when I was 15 and 16 years old and sort of in the swamp of trauma. I was seeing it now with the eyes of a woman in her 40s, you know, with a secure base from which to work. And amazingly, once those documents were retrieved, the state investigation refused to include them in their investigation into the school. And that was the point at which I thought, you know, you silenced me once and I'll be damned if you're going to do it again.
Well, let's go back to this assault, this incident, and I should say that you go back to it several times in the book. In fact, the book opens with a description of what happens to you. You use the word she and not I. Use that third person. I'm curious about, first of all, why you wanted to do that. Was to protect yourself, to protect us, your readers?
No, I'm sorry to say it wasn't.
Okay.
I don't think it was about protecting anyone. I guess I never was able to understand. This was the puzzle of the assault for me from the moment those boys let me go. Now, I should say I was 15. I was a virgin. I was a nerd. I was a chorister. I was the oldest child of, you know, fairly socially conservative parents who adored me and I adored them. And I allowed myself to be lured to the room of these two older boys, both of whom had serious girlfriends, had never been interested in me. I had no expectation of anything like that or even desire of anything like that. One of them was crying on the phone. He told me something had happened to his mom, and I thought I would be brave and wise and go help him out. And it was a trap. And they turned it into a violent moment pretty quickly, yeah. And they forced themselves on me. When I left the room, I thought, you know, I'm okay. I'm physically all here. I'm even still dressed. But I'm shattered. I'm utterly devastated. And I could not understand the relationship between those two things, the disparity there. So for me, writing the assault in the third person in the cleanest and quickest way I could is a way of getting out of the way the details of it, because that's sort of the least interesting part of it to me. It's what followed that I wanted to write about.
Well, and not to spend a lot of time on words, but words obviously matter, especially when talking about something like a sexual assault. And you struggle with trying to figure out what is the word that described what happened to me.
Well, exactly. And it's I don't know how detailed to be with regard to sensitivities of your listeners, but I certainly was not in possession of words like felonious aggravated sexual assault when I was 15 or 16 years old. I wouldn't have been familiar with the concept of consent even when I was 15 or 16 years old. I think it was different back then. And I did not understand even what the boys meant when the next day one of them hissed at me, threesome. Even that was a word that I had to figure out. So for me, it's been a process really my whole life since then of developing the vocabulary that allows me to tell this story in a way that takes some of its power from me.
You use the word, here we are talking about words again, but you know, words are powerful under these circumstances. You use the word erasure.
Yeah, so they called me. One of them called me. This boy called me. He was in my math class. He was that boy in high school, the senior, the one who captains all the teams, the tallest one coming down the hall. Anyone who's been in an American high school knows exactly
sure.
the boy I'm talking about.
Yep.
And he called me on the payphone in our dorm from the payphone in his. That was how it was done. And he sounded like he was crying and he wanted my attention. And this was a flattering thing for me. So I think for me, it was a matter of trying to understand how these boys made a bet that they could trap me in their room and do whatever they wanted to me. They could turn this moment violent and I would have no recourse. There would be nothing that I could do. That had never happened to me before in my life when the two of them pushed me down. That had never happened to me before to be surprised like that. And it was clear to me in the moment that I didn't exist for them. And that kind of annihilation, that micro-annihilation, was the thing that devastated me first mm-hmm. and most.
I mean, erasure is silence, is not having a voice, it's hardly existing. To be graphic here, but I think also to be honest, you got a very serious case of oral herpes as a result of the sexual assault, and you describe peering into your mouth, trying to figure out what was going on there. I think you describe it as feeling as if you had swallowed a piece of glass, and this went on for some time.
Right. Well, so the boys forced themselves in my mouth and down my throat in a way that made it difficult for me to breathe. And about a week after that, I developed this terrible pain deep in my throat, but nobody could see anything was wrong. I couldn't see anything in the mirror. There was nothing wrong with my mouth. I went to the infirmary at school thinking maybe I had strep throat, and they said, no, your tonsils look fine. You know, maybe you're just tired. It wasn't until I was losing a lot of weight and running a high fever, I couldn't eat, I could barely drink, that I was sent to an ear, nose, and throat specialist in town. They were able to see that I had herpetic lesions in the hypopharyngeal space. That's way, way deep in the throat, past the gag reflex, effectively. This is clinical evidence of a felonious assault, sure, by the way, you know, particularly in a 15-year-old girl. But I didn't learn until 2017, when I got a hold of my medical records, that the school knew that I had contracted herpes in October of 1990 when I was 15 years old. The school knew that. I was in the infirmary. My parents at home in Chicago were calling, frantic, worried about what was wrong with me. My pediatricians at home thought I had maybe leukemia or lupus or a horrible autoimmune disease that had caused my throat to slough off in this way. And the school refused to tell me or my parents or my doctors what was wrong. They kept me in the dark. They kept me sick.
I mean, they kept you sick. I mean, obviously part of this larger cover-up about what happened. You didn't tell anyone on campus. Did you have close friends? I mean, people that you consider? I think you mentioned a classmate named Caroline. The idea of revealing to someone who you could confide in, did that ever cross your mind?
I did have good friends, but no, because I hadn't yet confided in myself about what had happened, if that makes sense. So
sure, it does.
I was so busy trying to be good. This was my junior year in a high school that has this self-important mythology about itself, that if you succeed here, you can succeed anywhere, frankly. And I think for about 150 years, that was probably true for students who were born into the privilege of a place like St. Paul's School. I wanted to do everything right. When I went to this boy's rooms, I was pretty sure it was my fault what ensued. I was the fool for having gone there, and I should have anticipated somehow that they would push me down and attack me one after the other. Mm. And I was going to do everything in my power to just make sure nobody ever found out. They, of course, told everyone. So no, I didn't tell my friends. I was horrified and ashamed that this had happened to me. And in a way, I wanted to divorce myself from the girl it had happened to. I didn't want to be her anymore. And so I went kind of silent, and I lost a lot of friends that way.
Well, we're almost up at a break here. I mean, this is I think there are 500 students or several hundred students at St. Paul's. It is a boarding school, so everyone, in a sense, lives together on this campus. So it's not as if you could go home to your, you know, to your other life outside of school.
There's nowhere you can go. And even the counselors, you know, live on campus and they know all the other students, right? So there really was no safe and private place, nowhere.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation with Lacey Crawford. We're talking about her memoir. It's called Notes on a Silencing, and it's about what happened to her in 1990. She was 15 years old, a junior at St. Paul's School, and she was sexually assaulted by two 18-year-olds. They were seniors, upperclassmen, and it's about what happened to her and the aftermath of that. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Lacey Crawford. We're talking about her new book, a memoir titled Notes on a Silencing. And again, it's a difficult conversation, but an important one. It's about being sexually assaulted in high school, the role that gender and power played in the attack and the aftermath, and also the length that the school, frankly, other institutions go to protect themselves. Let me get back to your story before we get some callers in on the conversation. At what point did you decide to tell your parents?
I told my mom in May. So it was about 6 months later, maybe five months later. And I'm not sure what it was, the final breaking point. There are a couple things that I depict in the book, but it took me that long to be able to call my mom from the payphone in the dorm, the same phone, and tell her what had happened.
What was her response?
She was wonderful. She said, "Were you raped?" Which was a complicated question given where I was penetrated and what I understood to be true about rape and myself. And she said, "Are you safe now?" And she said, "We will bring you home." And what began was a very complicated negotiation about how to get me out of the school and the school year without it costing too much more than I had already lost. But the minute she flew me home, the school, which had been informed of the reason why, of course, began their own investigation, which was effectively the beginning of their formal silencing of me.
Well, in fact, they did their quote-unquote investigation, but they never talked to you.
No, they didn't. They talked to some of my friends and some other boys on campus. They helped themselves to my medical records, and they even took the liberty of gathering up some of the varsity athletes on campus that spring, the men, and letting them know that if they had ever been intimate with me, they should head to the infirmary to be checked for sexually transmitted diseases. So they spread the word on campus that I was sick before I had even been formally diagnosed by my pediatrician at home, which means that students on campus knew I had herpes before I did.
Wow. And just to add to that, they called your parents essentially, I don't know if threatening is too strong a word, but they basically said that if you, I guess, involve some kind of criminal investigation, they were going to go after you. And several of the things that they said about you was that you were a drug user. You were a drug user who had sold Prozac and other drugs to students on campus, that you regularly abuse privileges and circumvent rules on campus, that you're a promiscuous girl who has had intercourse with a number of boys on the campus, including the accused, that you're not welcome as a student at St. Paul's. They said this to your parents.
Right. So it was a very simple silencing. I was brought to my pediatrician in Chicago. I told her the whole story. She's a mandated reporter. So she reported this, you know, sexual assault of a minor to the state of New Hampshire, at which point the New Hampshire police got involved. The school hadn't reported to them, but the New Hampshire police got involved. And they said, well, the boys were 18 and you were 15. And we have clinical evidence of the STD you contracted in your throat. And we have medical records throughout the year. This is a pretty clear cut case, we're going to press charges against these two. The school had let them graduate, had given prizes, a top prize to one of them. And they, with their lawyers, told my father on the phone, look, you know, if Lacey testifies against these boys, because the state would have brought charges, but I would have testified against them. Sure. If Lacey's on the stand, this is what we're going to say about her. We're going to say that she's a drug dealer and she sold her Prozac, which I took for a brief period of time. And it's, you know, it's funny now. We sort of joke about, you know, hey, do you want to, you know, minimally improve your baseline? Like, you know, I've got some Prozac I can offer you. But I suppose in 1990, that was something that they could argue, and that I was not a good girl and that I was not welcome back on campus. And the minute I said that I did not wish to go forward with charges, the school said, oh, you know, on second thought, she can come back and she can finish her senior year, and all was well.
I mean, you did go back, and I'm trying to imagine, so you're 16 years old, trying to imagine then what it was like to go back to that campus where the boys had graduated, but the school was still there. There were still plenty of classmates who claimed that they knew what had happened to you. What was that like for you as a teenager?
Well, that was a wild experience, and it was very much my choice to go back. I didn't want to let the boys have the school, too. I didn't want to leave such that I didn't even get to graduate from my high school because of what they had done to me. And I knew that there was this kind of unwritten contract with my father that as long as I didn't testify against the boys and I didn't talk about what had happened, the school would not get in my way. So I pushed my boundaries a little bit for the first time once I got back. I used to go wandering around at night out of my dorm, and faculty, when they saw me across campus, they did nothing about it. I was untouchable.
You were untouchable.
Yeah, I mean they weren't gonna do anything to discipline me because they knew that I was sitting on this, you know, tinderbox of a story, and I didn't realize at that point the power that I had because I felt, you know, powerless to the core. But I realize now as an adult that the school had worked out how to silence me and was doing everything it could to get me through and off its campus so that the problem could be swept under the rug yet again.
As you mentioned, the boys graduated. One of them got a prize at graduation. What do you know about them now?
Very little. I do know that they were contacted by detectives as part of the investigation in 2017, that they did not deny the details of that night. They claim it was consensual, but they have not denied any of the details of the statutory assault. One of them has been entangled with the criminal justice system for most of his life. He was arrested for the first time 6 months after he graduated from St. Paul's School. The other one, I have subsequently learned, physically assaulted a boy in our dorm, held a knife to his throat in their dorm in our boarding school the year before. That has now been reported to the police. He has assaulted other women who have told me that it happened to them, though not to the degree that it happened to me. So it's clear that I was not the only one. Even in this way, I was not the only one.
Do you, we have a tweet sort of wondering why you haven't named them. Are you tempted in any way to out them?
No, I'm not. And this is such a good question, and I understand it so much. I didn't name any of the students in my book. Everyone has a pseudonym because we were all of us kids. And I think if I named these boys, then it becomes about them and about their being bad actors. And it is true that what they did to me was a horrible thing. But what the school did to me, the culture of the place, and the way those priests, I mean, it's an Episcopal school, the way the priests, the leaders, the faculty work to silence me, that to me is the far greater villain. And that, I think, is where I'm hoping that the Me Too conversation can go, is not just identifying who the bad guys are and initiating due process wherever possible, but acknowledging what systems in our society allow this to continue. So I didn't name them in large part because I didn't want this book to become about them. This is my story. This is, and I'd like the spotlight on other things.
What has been the school's response to your book? It's been out, a couple of weeks now?
It's been out a couple of weeks. The school, being St. Paul's School, got a hold of a copy of it about a year ago now, in a very early version, and distributed it among the trustees to some extent. So they read it long before my parents had the opportunity to read it, for example. I was still working on copy edits. The headmaster, the new headmaster of St. Paul's School, she's in her second year, is named Kathy Giles, and she's the first woman who has been the rector of St. Paul's School in the school's 160-plus year history. She did reach out to me after she had read the book, and we agreed to meet for lunch when she was out here in California on business. And she and I have a many months long, very careful, very candid conversation between the two of us. If there's any hope for the school to change, it will be because she is now at the helm. I have not been impressed by the way trustees have responded. Until last week, I had heard from nobody else at the school except for the rector. No one who was in the administration or faculty when I was, assaulted. No one who is on the board of trustees of the administration now. Not a soul.
Who reached out to you last week?
I mentioned this fact in a live event that I did with a bookstore with Kathy Giles, and I hadn't heard from anybody. And three trustees with their tails between their legs sent me emails the next morning. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I mean, does that mean something to you?
to
hear, I mean, here you are, a grown woman. Obviously, this happened many years ago, but to hear from trustees, does that help mitigate some of the hurt and anger?
I didn't write this book as a letter to St. Paul's. I'm not sending my children there. I wrote this book because I thought the particulars of my experience could be useful to other people, either survivors or the people who are trying to protect them, because it shows how an institution will protect itself and its reputation at the expense of a victim. And this happens everywhere, all the time. So what I'm looking for is not an apology. I didn't sue. There is no remedy for me, for the girl I was. That girl is gone. What I'm looking for is repair. So what I'm hoping to hear from anyone involved with the school is, this is how we are changing things, and your experience is a roadmap to that. That is the only song that I'm interested in their singing right now.
But do you want them to, is it important for them to believe you? And we talk a lot about that in this sort of Me Too era that we're in.
Yeah, I mean, I chuckled a little bit because if they don't, if they don't, all hope is lost, because I have such a lucky case. It was documented in so many ways. We have clinical evidence from a pediatrician. We have complete, you know, police case files from the same year. We have contemporaneous witnesses. The boys have confessed, right? So it's, there isn't even the question of belief, I don't think. It is rather a question of, will these people allow themselves to understand the gravity of what is done, you know, under their noses? Will they let themselves truly appreciate how lives are torn apart?
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Lacey Crawford, and her new memoir, just out a couple of weeks ago, Notes on a Silencing, is about how she was sexually assaulted at St. Paul's, a New Hampshire boarding school, how the school covered up what happened to her, and how through her own investigation and an attorney general investigation in New Hampshire has uncovered a number of the events that happened to her, how she was treated, and what this means for institutions and, frankly, what it means for the rest of us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We got a tweet from Mark who says, my daughter was raped on campus at a college in the Hershey area, Hershey in Pennsylvania. The school bullied her almost from the outset into withdrawing her criminal complaint. They put her on academic suspension, threatening her scholarships, which is just the saddest, most kind of frightening thing. Lacey, you want to respond to Mark?
I want your daughter to email me so that we could talk. Yeah. Because I know, and I am so sorry, and I am infuriated on her behalf. And this is the playbook. What Mark has just laid out is exactly how it's done. You identify the victim as the problem, and then you make an institution-wide case for eliminating the victim from the community. And in that way, all the attention shifts from the rape, you know, and the rapist, frankly, to the victim. There are options open to you, Mark, but I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
You say, and Mark, I appreciate that tweet is such an important part of the conversation. Lacey, you say that your story is not a remarkable story. In many ways, it's a very ordinary story. Do you feel, though, in the last couple of years with Me Too, that we're hearing, first of all, more about it, and that women or victims are more likely to be believed?
I do. I think there has been a shift undoubtedly in American culture, you know, in the wake of Me Too, and certainly the, you know, Tarana Burke's genius in joining all of these voices that had been silenced in various ways, sometimes even by themselves. You know, we're complicit with our own silencing because we think no one will believe us. To join all those voices is a kind of undeniable wave. And then there's been the work of Jody Kantor and Megan Toohey, who, you know, chased Weinstein until he could no longer escape, and Ronan Farrow too. And it's important to unmask these figures and to see them face the music. But what I think we haven't yet talked about is exactly what Mark shared with us, which is how these, you know, illustrious institutions, these well-founded institutions, make the problem go away. You never hear the rapist's name. You just hear the name of the victim who's asked to leave.
Well, help us understand how you see that kind of institutional, it's even beyond denial, the sort of, you know, pulling up of the you know, the moat, in a sense, the kind of self-protectiveness that an institution goes in. Do you understand that the institution matters more than the person? Because we're talking about churches, we're talking about the military. I mean, there are institutions all over where this is a common story.
I mean, I think I understand it to the extent that it is much easier to decide that one person is a little bit off. You know, the tagline for a victim is that she's a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. This is the, you know, the defense attorney's strategy always. It's much easier to put all of this on a victim than it is to have a cold look at the institution that elevates usually men who are aggressive, possibly violent, and then puts them in leadership positions or positions of power so that they're untouchable. I think it's much easier to say the girl was the problem than to say, God, we've got to reconsider how we're organized and how power is functioning here. That's a really difficult conversation, and that's a conversation being forced all across the country right now with regard to things in addition to gender, and it's high time.
Well, it's interesting you use the word slutty. That was said about Anita Hill, a little bit nutty, a little bit slutty, obviously absolutely insane thing to say about Anita Hill. But you say at the very end of your book that you almost welcome that word slut, because you say with a slut, it gives you voice, it gives you power rather than being silenced. Help us understand that.
Well, right. So what I wrote is that the opposite of the word slut is not virtue, but voice. So I believe that when we slut shame a girl or a woman, when we basically say to her, your voice is not as responsible as it should be. You are not a reliable witness to your own experience because you have been sexually active in whatever way. What we're trying to do is shut her up. That's what we're trying to do. So all of that morality has a kind of underlying purpose. And the underlying purpose is to make sure that nobody listens to her. So one of the ways I was able to sort of cast off the shame that was hurled at me by the school and by the community is to realize that it wasn't actually a question of my morality, my being a good girl or a bad girl or anything in between. It was a question of my having a story they didn't want people to hear.
Yeah. I mean, this whole idea of a good girl, right?
Yeah. Yes.
What is that about?
What is that about? Well, I mean,
yeah.
how long is our discussion this
morning?
Yeah,
exactly.
Because I think we'd have to start at the very beginning there. But I think a good girl is a girl who trusts herself and who is willing to tell the truth. And by that metric, almost all the girls I know are good girls, and that's all there is to it.
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation with Lacey Crawford. Again, she's got a new book. It's a memoir titled Notes on a Silencing. It's about being abused, sexually assaulted, I should say, when she was 15 years old. She was a junior at St. Paul's School, and two senior classmen assaulted her. She contracted an STD from that assault. The school spent much energy and time covering up the event. She was even threatened that she couldn't come back to the school if she testified against the two classmates. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me just recap here, especially if you are just joining our conversation. In October 1990, when Lacey Crawford was a junior at St. Paul's, an elite New Hampshire boarding school, she was sexually assaulted by two seniors at the school. She told no one and soon was suffering from an untreated STD. While she was struggling to cope with what happened to her, the school let those two students graduate without a blemish on their record and made her out to be the problem student. She kept quiet for many years, but after a recent investigation revealed a school cover-up, she decided to speak out, and her new book is titled Notes on a Silencing. Here's a question from Danielle, who says, why doesn't your guest sue the school? It seems the only way to get these large institutions to reform. What do you say about that?
So a lot of people have tried that. They've tried that with St. Paul's School. And here's what happens. St. Paul's School has an endowment worth, I think, about $750 million right now. So to be perfectly frank, my family would have had to hire a very expensive lawyer. And we would have had to go up against the school with the documents that I had. We would have been offered a settlement for sure, because the school would not have wanted to proceed to trial because of everything that would have come out. And the terms of that settlement, I'm quite sure, would have demanded that I not say anything about what had happened to me. So it would have been something like a non-disclosure agreement, and it would have come with a nice price, a nice check. But to me, the way to force reform is to, frankly, embarrass the school, you know, into talking about the way it's put together and the way it has operated for so very long. And this was the only way to do that.
You mentioned that you heard from the headmaster, or I guess headmistress, I'm not sure which word you use, but what has the school, and you've also heard from some trustees as well, but the overall school response, have they instituted any reforms because of your book or even because of this Attorney General investigation in New Hampshire?
Right. So this is a long story, and I'm coming in at the end of, you know, decades of assault on campus at St. Paul's. The reason the state investigation was opened in 2017 was because so many people had come forward, first with reports of faculty on student assault. So there were faculty members who were abusing students for decades. And only then did the student on student assault stories begin to come out. And I'm sort of at the forefront of that, with the exception, of course, of Chessie Prout, who was a freshman who was raped on the campus of St. Paul's when she was 15 years old by a senior who was then tried, and it was a very public trial. And her family did, in fact, bring a civil suit against the school, and they did settle, and they settled because they needed to save their family and move forward with their lives. So this is a long story.
Sure.
The terms of the settlement agreement between the state of New Hampshire Attorney General's office and St. Paul's School require there to be a compliance officer on campus for up to 5 years. He's there now. He's terrific. Whose job it is to look around at the systems of the school, identify why kids are being victimized and what needs to be changed. And he's doing that. I will say that the reforms have not been as fast as I would like them to have been. I can't fathom why they weren't done before the state investigation was launched. I also know that Kathy Giles, who's the rector, this is the term we use for the head of St. Paul's, has been in place for a year. And my book has been out for, you know, a month. So she's working as fast as she can. It's not fast enough because we're sitting on about 70 years of student abuse that's been covered up. Wow. But I think as far as institutions go, you know, eyes and ears open to see what comes next.
Well, St. Paul's is not the only boarding school or New England boarding school that has come under this cloud. It seems, you know, every couple of months or so, we hear about other incidents at other boarding schools. Do you think it's unique to boarding schools or no?
Oh, I don't think it's unique to boarding schools, but I think boarding schools are a sort of petri dish of opportunity, you know.
Because everyone's living together so close.
Everyone is living together, and the students don't have their parents, right? There's no context that you can step into outside of high school. Imagine that. Imagine a high school you can never leave, right? That's what boarding school is. So, you know, you can be preyed upon. And then there's, you know, there's the promise of these boarding schools. There is the self-important mythology of, you know, the elite, and that you are a part of this if you survive and succeed at this school. So the stakes of speaking up, knowing that you'll be exiled if you do, the stakes of speaking up are enormously high. And I know people who allowed themselves to be torn apart rather than to seek help because they knew that they would have to give up all of the ambitions they had, say for college, you know, or their imagining of a life beyond that. So I do think that there's something about the added layer of sort of self-important elitism that a lot of these boarding schools have, and also the money, frankly, that they're sitting on, the enormous pots of money, that in some ways makes it even more grotesque. But this is obviously, as we know from investigations into the church, into you know, branches of the military, into corporate America, this is hardly a problem isolated to New England boarding school campuses.
I'm curious about the Attorney General investigation. There was a grand jury that was called. Were you ready to testify before the grand jury?
Oh, I was so ready to testify. I had all but packed my roller bag, you know, to fly to New Hampshire and tell them what I knew and show them the documentation that I had. And I was not invited to do that. I was not even told why I was not invited to do that. Rather, I received an email along with several thousand other alumni of the school being told, you know, that the acting rector at the time, with great pleasure, was announcing that they had reached a settlement with New Hampshire. And even though the school waived their confidentiality to a grand jury report, subsequent people whose legal fees were paid for by the school petitioned the judge to keep everything sealed, and the judge agreed. So nothing that was emerged in that investigation will ever come out.
Does that feel like another silencing then?
That's exactly what it is. And so, you know, I hope there are a lot of memoirs on their way, frankly. I hope that, you know, because there are a lot of voices to be heard. And, you know, it's unclear exactly why that decision was made. And there are people who are pushing to try to change that. But I think ultimately, you know, transparency needs to start with the school and it needs to start now. So I'm hoping that my book is the beginning of that.
Have you heard from your former classmates who have either read your book or read about it?
I have been flooded, and this has been, it was unexpected, and it has been beautiful, and it has been heartbreaking. So I have heard from, as of today, almost 100 alumni of St. Paul's School. This is in addition to the friends I was already in touch with who read early drafts and knew what I was up to. And one third, actually slightly more than one third of those almost 100 alumni have reported to me their own assaults on campus at St. Paul's School. At that same school. And I started keeping a list when they wrote to me because I wanted to make sure I replied to everyone. And that list is now pages long in my notebook. And if it's someone who tells me about an assault, I make a little check mark by their name. And it is this absolutely heart-wrenching poem now that I have in my notebook of this community that I'm a part of and was always a part of. I just didn't know.
A poem. Interesting you describe it that way.
Well, it's truth. It's truth at long last. And to me, it's a beautiful thing that we're all together now. And I'm so grateful to every single person who has come forward to support me in one way or another.
So were these happening when you were on campus, when you were dealing with your own sexual assault?
In most cases, they were, because most of the people who have written to me knew me. They were either a year or two or three older than I was, or a year or two or three younger than I was. Several people have written in with stories about the two men who assaulted me, you know, their own experiences with them, because everybody knows who they are at the school. It's an open secret. And then there are, you know, much younger alumni. The youngest is just graduated from college in May, the youngest survivor who's contacted me. And I spoke last night to a man whose life was destroyed in the early 80s as a result of abuse at the hands of a faculty member. The rot is deep. And I hope that we can finally talk about it and try to bring some sunlight here.
Absolutely. Here's a question from Carol. Why do rapes that occur in high school and college seem to be deemed less of a felony? Usually the only consequences that occur are suspension or expulsion, which is barely a punishment. I mean, we're talking in your case, you were 15 years old. You were a child. They were 18. They were adults.
Exactly. And this is how it happens. There are two systems of justice that are running side by side. There's what the police would do. There's the criminal justice system. And then there's what the school, the institution will do, right? The high school or the college. And those are two different tracks, and they very rarely match up. So in my case, and I think my case is a good example of how this is done, I very well could have pursued prosecution of the boys. They probably would have been convicted at great cost to me and my family in terms of what was going to be said about me on the stand, at which point they would have been expelled. But the risk to me was so great that I said, no, let's not go ahead with charges. Let's not press charges. I just want to go back to high school and be a girl. And the school at that point shrugged and said, all right, well, that's fine. The boys have already graduated and there's nothing for us to do. And so I think schools wait to see if the criminal justice system will, you know, prosecute. And if they don't, then the school says, well, if they're not going to, we're sure not going to. And students are allowed to remain on campus and remain in classes with, in many cases, the girls they've assaulted. And this is a devastating thing.
Well, I can only imagine. I mean, you write about seeing these two boys or men, we should say, they were 18 years old, seeing them as you were going from class to class or maybe even sharing a classroom with them.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And the one who had called me, who was the more aggressive of the two, was in my math class. And, you know, he was two desks ahead of me for the rest of that year. So I don't remember much except not being able to eat and being in pain and, you know, going the other way when I saw him coming.
You did graduate from St. Paul's. You went to Princeton University. You're married. You have a couple of kids. Was there a point in your life where you could, in a sense, turn your back, almost like not even think about what happened to you? Or was it there sort of gnawing at you all the time?
I think it wasn't so much memory of the event that was gnawing at me, but rather the way I was oriented toward myself and the world from a very young age. So having decided at 15, 16 that there was no one who would protect me, that if I spoke up, I would be slandered and shamed, that I could not count on friends, that I probably was a bad person and guilty in some way, that shadowed me for all of my 20s and almost killed me, frankly. It really did. The repercussions of the event and the silencing almost killed me. So it wasn't until I saw the documents that I saw in 2017 that I was able to finally validate, even truly in my own bones, the experience that I have always known was true.
What do you mean almost killed me?
I mean, I was quite openly suicidal by my late 20s. I had a very hard time going out into the world and building a life. And I had this education that suggested that I should be able to do a lot of things. And my experience of the world was that I could do nothing. And it was very, very hard for me to reconcile the resources that I had been given with my inability to take steps to build a world for myself.
Oh, it's so heartbreaking. How were you able to do that? Because clearly you have.
I crashed, I burned, I found a great therapist, I got really lucky, I got down on my knees a couple times, I had a really great dog. I don't mean to be flippant.
I believe in dogs.
These are the things. I got to the point, I think, where I realized that I couldn't pretend that I hadn't been torn apart. And once I was willing to acknowledge that that was where I was and that was where I was starting from, then I was in a position to start to put things back together. But it took me till I was about 29 years old to admit that, to wave my white flag.
We mentioned the fact that your husband said, go get him. Almost. I mean, sounds like he was also, besides your dog, you know, important in helping you heal.
I met him well into that process, and I'm not sure that if I had met him before, I would have recognized him as the man he is and as someone I wish to have in my life. I think for so long, I know that I chose partners who managed to continue the shaming of me in very private ways for a long time, and I know other survivors often experience the same. So it was only coming through to the other side that enabled me to form the marriage that I have with him now.
I'm so glad to hear that. Let me read an email from Deb. I was in college in the late 80s. It was basically accepted that a socially active woman at college would be sexually assaulted and perhaps raped. One of the biggest benefits of being in a sorority seemed to be that we shared unwritten knowledge of which boys to make sure you didn't let yourself be alone with. A kind of a, almost like a secret society to protect other women. What do you think about that, Lacey?
God, I mean, how fantastic that women do that for each other. How devastating that women have to do that for each other. I mean, that to me is obscene, you know. And what it means to me is that the boys aren't policing each other. That's what that means. So the girls are looking out for each other, but the boys aren't claiming their own. Because don't tell me that all the girls in the sorority knew which boys, if they had a few beers, would be likely to do X, Y, Z, without the boys in those frat houses also knowing which boys those were. I mean, I've heard from men who knew the men who assaulted me, and they said, I've always known who did this to you, and they were my buddies, and I'm so sorry.
And I'm so sorry. You mentioned your parents early on. What's been their response to your book then?
They've been devastated for 30 years.
Sure.
You know, I mean, this happened to their little girl 30 years ago, and I'm not sure that... I shouldn't speak for them. I know that they are thrilled and proud of the life that I've been able to build, but I am not sure that the experience of having the school that they trusted, my mom is also a priest, and this was a church school that they trusted, betray them in this way is something that they have been able to move through. And I don't know how a parent could, truly. No. I don't know how a parent could.
No, I mean, from one parent to another. So, Lacey, is there anything you would take back in your book?
Meaning I wish I hadn't written it.
Yep.
Yeah, there were a couple of things that I took out in our final legal review because I didn't have evidence of them. They were things that administrators had done that were appalling but that were not directly related to me. And I took them out just to be 100% sure that everything could be fact-checked. And in the days after my book was published, people wrote to me and told me those stories and offered me evidence of them. So if anything, I wasn't bold enough.
Well, I appreciate that you wrote this book. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Lacey Crawford's new book, her memoir, Notes on a Silencing. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.